This is a Glassbox Media podcast.
The podcast where we talk to well-known people about their lives, their careers, and those difficult blank moments along the way. I'm Giles Paley Phillips, and with me is Jim Daly.
Hello. That's the least lavish intro you've done for me. I think I was expecting description or something about the football shirts behind me, but you went straight in there to Jim Daly.
Well, we've done football shirts behind you before.
We have. Yeah, it's a bit boring, isn't it? Sorry. Anyway, sorry. It was a lovely intro. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm good, actually. Yeah, not too bad at all. Actually, not too bad at all. Having a good week, and feeling good, to be honest.
What does a good week look like to you then?
Lots of time with the family, but also like work to pay the bills and stuff. But I've had a bit of both this week. Yeah, it's been a nice mix. I think it's getting that balance, isn't it, between sort of work and personal life. And I feel like I'm just about there at the moment, actually.
Is the good week, the balance, getting the balance.
Yeah.
Balance, like generally, just balance in life is, you know, where we can get. So a good week is balance.
I agree.
Stick it on a t-shirt.
We keep saying that. I've lost count of the number of times we've said that and what we've said we're going to put on t-shirts. We do have merchandise available, though. Please do buy podcastmerch.co.uk/blank.
Sets them up and he hits them.
Rolls it across the box, taps it into an empty net. I think balance is a good thing to aim for. Not always easy. I appreciate that. It's very easy to say, oh, yeah, just find balance. Like, it's not always easy. But I think when it does happen, nice to acknowledge it, because I'm sure next week will be off.
So I'm a Libran, so I'm sort of constantly.
Oh, as in your star sign's Libra.
My star sign's Libra.
You're a librarian for a second,
I wish. What a great job that would be.
Yeah,
I'm a Libran, so my star sign's Libra. Yeah, so I'm kind of constantly striving for balance.
Of course, mine's Gemini. So am I constantly striving to be two people at once?
Well, that comes up in the podcast quite a lot today.
Yeah, it does.
As a nice segue into introducing our guest this week. So we've got the wonderful Michelle Ackerley on, who is a broadcaster, does lots of stuff for the BBC, loads of live broadcasts, done stuff for The One Show, Crime Watch, and she's just a wonderful human being and really enjoyed chatting to Michelle. But we did talk a lot about your alter ego, Jim.
We did. I do. I think actually that's probably 1 minute.
Boring!
I think that's why I'm in. I nearly told another story, another leaving work story during the podcast, but the conversation moved on. But I'll save it for another podcast, but I do have quite a lot of stories about leaving work. I was going to say, the reason that I'm feeling good today is we record these Top and Tales straight after the episode, and I'm actually, because it was such a lovely conversation with Michelle, I'm feeling quite good from that, I think. I think it sort of happens to us quite a lot, but doing the Top and Tail straight after leaves you in quite a sort of a pleasant mood, actually, and feeling quite buoyant about things. And that definitely was the case today.
Buoyant is the word I was going to use as well. It's definitely that. I feel very balanced and buoyant. Always feel there's a slight, I guess maybe it's because you get a bit of adrenaline and stuff from doing it. I guess there's that kind of nice warm feeling afterwards.
Yeah.
That's still churning around in you. But yeah, I always feel good after we've had a conversation. I think it's just having a conversation, isn't it? Having a chat with someone.
Yeah, but we're lucky. We get every week, unless I know the person beforehand, which is very rare, as in personally, I always feel like, oh, I've made a new friend this week. And that's always a really nice feeling. And we talk about this episode about sort of catching up with friends, don't we, during the pandemic and stuff, and those connections. But it's always nice coming away thinking, oh, well, I never know. At some point, I might bump into Michelle. Who knows? through work or something at some point. And that's a friend that I know. And that's always nice to think that after you've had these conversations. It's only an hour of people's time we're taking, but it's funny how quickly you can make those connections and sort of become friendly with someone over that time. But it takes them being a warm, friendly, open person, which she really is. So, it's a nice sort of nice little post-pod buzz, I would say.
Well, I mean, it's one of the reasons why I started the podcast, so I could get some new friends.
Well, you got me. I'm sorry, mate.
Or get some friends, not even new ones.
It's worked. 120 friends later.
133, come on.
Is that what, really? We're up to, oh, blimey. Yeah,
we're heading towards 150 episodes, Jim.
Wow. So are we getting the Obamas for 150 or was that for 200?
I think that was 300, actually. Still working on it. But anyway, we do get lots of nice messages as well about the podcast, which is always nice. Another post-pod buzz is increased by the fact that we get to look at all these lovely messages that come through to us and we can read some out. I've got one here from Penny Short. And this is in reply to the episode with Emma Jones. She said, enjoyed listening to this podcast so much today on my walk to and from work. Thank you for sharing your story. I laughed and I cried with you, Jim and Giles. Your blank podcast episodes are wonderful. I love working my way through them. Thank you.
That, I mean, what a fantastic episode that was with Emma. She's just one of the best people you'll ever meet. Mm. And that was just, another episode that left me sort of feeling warm inside afterwards. But Penny, thank you so much for that tweet. That's so lovely. And we do, I don't know about you, like, I'm sure you get lots of lovely tweets on your main feed, but I sometimes if I'm like doing nothing or feeling a bit flat, I do look down. I've got a little on TweetDeck, a little at blank pod column. And nice. It's just nice looking down through the tweets because they're always so lovely. And it does, it can give you a nice little boost actually during the day. So thank you to everyone that sends them in. It's very difficult actually to reply to them all because there's sort of so many that come in or like them. I do try and like as many as possible. But it's lovely. So please do keep sending them. We do really, really appreciate them and to read all of them if possible. And I've got one here from Maria. Excellent name choice, Maria. And she says, "Gah, grumpy," in capital letters. "So was almost asleep until all those notifications dinging because I forgot to turn off my phone. I'm awake now. Thanks, Crunchy, for the dulcet tones of my favourite Stephen Fry on Blank Pod to soothe me back to sleep. #1am, #insomnia Twitter, #insomnia. So there you go. Look, we're providing services as well, as well as podcasts. But yeah, well, I mean, the Stephen Fry episode is obviously a real corker. That was a good one.
Oh, brilliant. And yes, I've used that Calm app before, and Stephen Fry does a thing where he's sort of walking through a field of wheat a la Theresa May.
Theresa May.
But he's describing it, and it's so calming and wonderful. You get soothes you off to sleep very quickly. He's just got one of those voices, isn't he, Stephen? You could definitely a person you could get to describe walking through a field of wheat.
Definitely. I had someone the other day tell me in person, who was it, that they loved the Stephen Fry episode?
Don't often get the live feedback.
I think it was someone that I went to watch Palace last few games. I think it was someone at the pub before Palace game. But I said, well, it was an easy one for us to do because Stephen is such a professional at talking. I think we just said, "Hi, Stephen, how are you doing?" And an hour later, we're like, "Thanks very much, great podcast." He's just such a pro. We didn't really need to do anything.
Well, he just had so much interesting stuff to talk about. He obviously, there's stuff that he wants to chat about and discuss. You know, discuss is probably the best word to use, discuss.
Yeah.
And it was brilliant. It's just in awe of sort of sitting there like we're having a wonderful conversation, but just hearing him talk about his sort of views on the world.
So that was Pod 100, wasn't it? I think
it was Pod 100. Yeah.
So if you haven't heard that, do go back and listen to that and any of our episodes. Really, we've got fantastic guests for every single episode. So please do delve into the back catalogue if you are new to Blank, and if you are new to Blank, welcome, hello, and thanks for choosing us to listen to today, because there's a lot of podcasts out there, Giles. So I think
there are.
Every single person that chooses to listen to us, I really, really do appreciate, because there's many, many options out there. But and people are busy. People don't have a lot of time in their lives. So I think if you're choosing...
I was going to say, we waffle on quite a lot as well.
Which we have done in this intro. God, I'm so sorry. I have waffled today. I think we should crack on with the episode, really. Sorry. Every week I think, do you know what, let's make it a snappy intro this week.
Yeah. but often this is the first time we've spoken in a week. So
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
There's a lot to discuss.
We jump on for the pod and then, yeah, it's absolutely true. So it is nice catching up. I would love to see the stats of who hits the fast forward 10 second button on the app. I'm sure people do. Where is the guest? Let's get into the guest.
Listen, if you are listening to this and you do listen religiously to the intros and outros of this podcast, please tell us.
We need the validation.
We need validation. We need to be told that it's okay.
Or if you think we could trim it down a little bit, we're open to suggestions.
So, we're up for any kind of constructive criticism.
Constructive feedback we will take if you think we should shave down the top 10. We're still talking, Giles. Let's get into this week's episode. It's an absolutely fantastic conversation with the wonderful Michelle Ackley on the Blank Podcast.
I'm just distracted by all the football shirts. Is it behind you, Jim?
I have a slight eBay problem, unfortunately.
Slight.
In fact, actually, this morning I want to send one back I didn't like, so I'm working out what I want in place, which is... don't have the money to do it.
Oh, you have to get a replacement, even though you didn't like it.
Can't just get a refund. I need to obviously get something
what
else.
What was it? Can you reveal what it was?
It was a Brazil training t-shirt, which I thought was going to be like a normal t-shirt, but it's like a sort of football-y one, and I didn't like the quality of it. In it's a bit too...
incredibly niche.
Do you wear them out then?
Not really, no. I don't really wear them at all, Michelle, to be honest. They just sort of sit here.
Lovely background, Jim. My partner supports Brentford, so he's just ordered the... Corrupt FM. I don't know if you've seen people just do nothing. He's got the Corrupt FM Brentford t-shirt, so he's very happy about
amazing.
That.
Amazing. Oh, I'm desperate to see the new movie.
I saw it the other day. It's good. Oh. I was laughing out loud. It's brilliant.
Amazing.
I adore that show. I think it's just so
good. It's nice, isn't it?
And it's brilliant. And I guess if you're a Brentford person, you
recognize
quite a lot of it.
Yeah, well, he was born and bred in Brentford, so he's absolutely in his element at the minute with the film and the Premier League. There's a lot of excitement in this household.
I think they'll stay up. I actually think they'll
they're
doing really well.
Yeah,
and there's something really likable about that club as well, that the manager's got a lot of character, and
he has.
When they won that first game against Arsenal, they were sort of going around the pitch afterwards and shaking hands and hugging the fans. Like, it was just I think they won
great
a lot of people
atmosphere.
Over that moment. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe one of those t-shirts next for you, Jim.
Maybe.
That's what you could replace it with.
Palace should do. We support Crystal Palace, which is obviously not too far away from Brentford, but they should do a collaboration of some sort. That's
maybe.
A really good idea. That sort of that collab they did. I don't know. But I don't know who with or what with, but they're pretty cool. I like those sort of collab ideas.
It's creative, isn't it?
Yeah, it's nice.
So Michelle, we normally start at the beginning, which is kind of, I guess, where you grew up and school and stuff. Did you enjoy school? Was school a fun time?
School was a mixed time for me. So I grew up in Manchester when I was really young, and then moved over to Cheshire when I was kind of probably around 9-10 years old. And I'd moved schools when I was around 12-13. So I moved to an all-girls school in Cheshire, which was lovely, made some great friends. I think, it's interesting when you look back and reflect on things. I think probably a few of my insecurities may have stemmed from that time. I was the only mixed-race girl in the school, and I remember having a bit of a kind of to-do with the headmistress before I actually started at the school, because she said... you've passed the exam and we're really looking forward to having you, but you can't wear your hair in braids. You've got to have it straight. And my hair's afro, so it's never going to be straight unless I was to chemically straighten it. And wearing a braids, as a black person, a mixed race person, is a part of your identity and your culture. So there are always those bits during my time at school where I felt very different because, I looked different and there didn't seem to be that support initially. It did change over time. It was a mixed bag. I enjoyed my studies. I ended up being deputy head girl and, you know, got kind of stuck into my education. But from a kind of social and that sense of identity, you know, when you're growing up as a teenager and going through all sorts of things.
Oh, it's a really hard time, isn't it? It's a challenging time. I've got, obviously, we spoke before, I've got a 14-year-old and a 12-year-old, and they're sort of entering into that bit. And it is just, and all those horrible kind of things start to come back, those memories of insecurity, like you say. And you've got all that, and then plus, you've got that other added level of stuff that you're getting. And to not have that support from, like, the head of the school is...
Yeah, a head shouldn't be saying that, really.
I mean, she's not there now, thankfully. But, no, when you're a kid as well, you don't necessarily know, do you? It's only when I look back, I think, God, that... I mean, there's so many things we can look back on now and think, that wasn't right to say, or that wasn't right to do. Yeah. I think now for kids, especially with social media, there's a whole other element to school and identity and comparing yourselves to people and fitting in. It just, you know, it comes in cycles, but just something's always slightly different, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that sounds like you almost sort of started school on the wrong foot. I mean, that's not a great way to start already, I think. And I think, I don't know. I guess things hopefully have got better and have changed. But, I don't think a head teacher should be saying that to a new pupil, really.
No. But. Well, I remember kind of sitting there in her office and saying, but, OK, well, would you prefer me to have, you know, a big afro in school? Because I'm starting to sense that it's not about, you know, wearing my hair straight, having a certain kind of look, which was never going to be achieved by me anyway, because I don't look like that, you know. So it was a weird time to start with, but there was some great moments, and, you know, I'm still friends with people from school now, which is lovely to, you know, maintain those friendships over the years, for sure.
It's funny, isn't it, when you're younger you look up to adults and you think, oh, they know what they're doing. These guys, they've got to the level of adult, assuming, you know, some sort of like game show. We've got to the level of adult, so they know what they're doing. They know the rules. They know everything. And then you get to an adult and you think, oh, my God, they didn't have a fucking clue.
It's so true. I'm like 30, turned 37 the other month, and I'm like, oh, my God, like, I can't even say I'm, like, early 30s, mid-30s. Like, I'm nearly 40.
Yeah, I'm 37 too, so I'm exactly the same.
When you pass 35, it's nearly 40 for, like, 5 years.
I'm waking up in a cold sweat, Giles, thinking, oh, my shitting hell, I'm nearly 40. I'm an actual adult. You know, I just can't get away with things anymore. I'm really trying, but I can't.
When was the first time that you guys realised you're an adult? I can almost pinpoint my moment, and I would have been 24, 25 maybe. I think,
I'm quite young.
That is quite young. It seems young to me now, to be fair.
Oh, damn, I can't. It does actually, 20s do seem young. But someone said to me...
What was it?
Someone...
Were you wandering around a garden centre or something?
I was somewhere and like, I was like queuing behind a lady and her kid or something, and the kid was doing something, and the mum went, Don't hassle that gentleman or something, or be careful, that gentleman's there. I was like, what? Looking behind me, like, what? Oh, no, she means
shit
me.
Shit is me. Oh, God.
I definitely am. I clearly look like an adult. Well, that was,
For me, it was the other day, because I've just moved house and started to, like, chuck things out and buy bits of furniture. Mm. And I bought a shelf from IKEA and a TV stand, and I spent 2 days assembling them by myself and felt so proud. Like, I was posting it on social media, look at my shelf. I mean, the only people that do that are fully fledged adults. No one else is going to do that. But I was just like, this is my life now, and I'm loving it.
I had a similar thing. Well, I think it was not that I was an adult, but that I was turning middle-aged, was when I was walking along the seafront the other day, and I had my hands behind my back walking along with them crossed.
Oh, Giles.
And I thought, oh, no.
I love doing that, I save my hands behind the back walk for a Sunday. I love doing that on a Sunday morning.
I think it was a Sunday, to be honest.
I didn't realise that was an adulting thing as well, but it just feels so good. It's like you're strolling. Yeah, I'm a Sunday and I'm an adult.
It's like you're purveying. Yeah, I know. It's like I'm purveying my world. And No one's going to stop me.
I've not tried the hands behind the back thing.
Try it, Jim.
Sounds good.
Yeah, it feels good. Liberating. It feels great.
I'm going to do it from the walk from this cabin back to the house down the garden after this podcast.
Really slowly.
Really slowly. Yeah, and
you have to look at the flowers. You have to sort of look around. Look to the left. Look to the right.
Nod your head a bit. Nod your head. Yeah, maybe talk to yourself a bit. Exactly. There we go. Yeah. You've got it. You've got it.
I can't wait.
Oh dear.
Going back to school, so you were quite academic and obviously you did really well. Did you kind of have any inkling that you would end up doing what you're doing now? Was that something early doors that you were kind of interested in?
I was always into drama at school. I remember playing Dandy Dan in Bugsy Malone, Scrooge Scrooge. I loved a bit of acting, but I hadn't really thought about it as a career or, you know, kind of the media world as a career. I remember in sixth form, I did psychology at A level, and that for me was the first time where I thought, finding out a bit more about human behaviour and how people tick and different ways to communicate and having a structure of kind of science and experiments around it, for me was fascinating. And then, so I went on to study psychology at university, and it was kind of then that I started thinking more about the media as a possible career prospect. One of my tutors at the time was, I guess we'd call him like a media psychologist. So back in the days when, you know, Big Brother had just started and it was seen as this social experiment type thing, he as a psychologist would go on the various kind of, you know, TV channels and talk a bit more about body language and how humans are connecting in this very unfamiliar environment. And he was the one that got me thinking about this industry as a whole, so creative, and actually just using it as a vehicle to understand people better, not necessarily become a psychologist within TV, but just having that natural curiosity about people. I thought, actually, well, this could be a good industry to go in. And that's what kind of started my process. I applied for a work experience placement at the BBC in Manchester along Oxford Road, and got that, you know, 4 weeks work experience placement in entertainment, and that's how the kind of the journey started, as it were, really.
There's a lot. Oh, sorry, Charles.
Well, I was going to. I know this is a bit off topic, and it's going back to what you said. But you did Bugs Malone. We did Bugs Malone at school.
Did you?
And we had and the CDD department made proper splurge guns. Oh. Did you have?
I'm so jealous. You know, I remember asking at the time, because I was obsessed with the film Bugsy Malone.
Yeah, and
I,
so good. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I said to my drama teacher, Mrs. Riddell, are we going to get splurge guns? Because it needs to be a part of my contract. If I'm going to be Dandy Dan, I need to have a proper
That's
splurge gun.
That's my rider.
Exactly. But no, we just had the pies with the foam, and that was it.
Yeah.
Not quite the same.
Not the same. Yeah. Not the same at all. But it was great fun.
Yeah. Wow, Charles, I'm really impressed by that.
I know.
How did they work? Did they actually work?
Well, yeah, they actually shot. They actually fired. I mean, I to be honest, I was, I didn't make it into the production. I was, I had to do. I had to be involved in the teas. I had to like make teas at half time then at the interval.
Right.
So we just got to watch it. But
that's a pretty good gig, to be fair, isn't it?
It was quite fun just watching it, to be honest. I did feel like I was one of the naughty kids though, because it was all the naughty kids that weren't in it.
Making the teas and just chilling, watching it.
What was the splurge? What was it?
It was like sort of foamy stuff. I guess it was like white foam. Shaving foam or something.
I think ours was like shaving foam or cream or like whipped cream or something cream, like that.
It's funny, I didn't do any drama at school that I can think. We had a module year eight, I think, that I did for a bit. But it's funny we interviewed lots of different people on this podcast from different industries, but having an interest in drama at school seems to come up a lot.
Does it?
Charles? Like, yeah, I don't know why. It just seems to be a real sort of base for people that end up doing lots of creative things. It's just,
yeah.
So that was interesting.
I remember when I first started at this new school in Cheshire, and, you know, I was quite shy. It's a weird one, really, because I love drama and obviously presenting, but I am naturally quite shy, you know, chatting to people. But I remember starting and they put an advertisement out for, you know, people to audition for Bugsy Malone. And I thought, well, this is my opportunity to almost, you know, adopt a different persona and be this kind of flamboyant character. And through that, that's how I kind of got friendly with different people, you know, through the drama group. So it was almost like a weird vehicle to make friends, like be the shy one, but then pretend you're not and be in a drama production and then do it that way.
That's life, basically, isn't it? Be the shy one, but then pretend you're not, and then that'll just get you through adult life.
Exactly.
I think that's quite a common thing, though. I think if you're, you know, I think for a lot of people that actors and stuff we've had on, they are quite shy and reserved, and acting is a way for them to sort of be able to sort of come out themselves a little bit.
I find that with comedians as well. When I've spoken to a lot of comedians, actually, maybe there's an expectation on them to, you know, you sit there and it's like, make me laugh, when actually they're just, again, normal people. That it's like the downtime, do you know what I mean? They're not kind of just on to make people roar with laughter 24/7.
Yeah, I think there's...
That'd be incredibly tiring, wouldn't it? If you had to despite make people laugh constantly.
24/7. No rest, no sleep. Yeah. Just
go down Tesco's.
I'll pitch that. to a commission, see how it goes down.
I think we all, whatever industry you do, there's always an element of sort of switching on, I think. Like, and I'm sure you've had it as well. There's days sometimes where you think, I'm not ready for today. I'm not in the mood today. But you know, you have to then suddenly sort of, once the camera starts rolling or you know, whatever, you have to sort of turn it on a bit. And I think I guess that is a professionalism, I guess. But I think we all have that to some element, I think.
I had it yesterday, actually. And I think it's been weird, especially with, you know, the pandemic. We've all been working in different ways. I've got used to, you know, doing my job virtually as well as face-to-face and maybe not travelling as much. And I had a day of meetings yesterday, what I call, you know, the wanky telly meetings, where you go in and you're like, oh, hello, I'm amazing, pick me. Oh, here are all my ideas. Oh, yeah. And I just got up yesterday and I was like, I can't psych myself up to be that dynamic Michelle. Oh, you know, I'm brimming with ideas and I'm so excited to be. I just like... Oh my God, it's some days it just really feels like an effort. And I had to like talk to myself in the mirror, like, come on, get in the game here. Get yourself sorted. Get on it. Like a crazy woman. Because it is, I don't think anyone, well, some people maybe just have that naturally. But for me, like you said, Jim, it's very much at times switching it on, switching into that mode and then switching off again at the end of the day.
Did the mirror talk work? Because I've never tried that.
I think it did. Yeah, I mean, I'm very hard on myself, so I always come out of meetings thinking, how did that go? I shouldn't have said that. I mean, I carried on talking, so I'm sure some of it might have landed, but, you know, we'll see what happens.
That's something that comes up a lot again on the podcast, is this sort of post-match analysis that we do with ourselves after anything, really, after any conversation. I'm sure I'll do it after we've had this podcast today. Yeah. Is that something that happens a lot for you as well?
All the time. And I thought, you know, now that I'm a fully fledged adult who likes to walk around with the hands behind the back and talk to themselves.
Been for a couple of months now.
Well, this is it, exactly. New to the team. I honestly thought, like my younger self, that by this age I would have it all sorted. I'd be so settled in myself, secure, confident. Yeah, me too. Not to say in some areas of my life I'm not. But I still have crippling anxiety. I still have so many insecurities. I think what I've realised now is that I have to embrace that and I recognise it rather than trying to hide it and not talk about it. It's one of those things that is a part of me. And, you know, I was speaking to my mum on the phone this morning and she's like, how are you doing? I was like, I'm all right, but, you know, I'm feeling a bit anxious. I'm about to do 3 weeks for Crime Watch, which is live every day. And, you know, I mean, I've done it for 7 or 8 years now, but at the start of the run, I'm always like, oh, am I going to be okay? Am I going to be able to do it? Do you know what I mean? And so my mum, it was just lovely speaking to my mum. She's just like a proper northern man. She's like, Michelle, right, come on now. And sometimes you need that other person to just be like, let's look at the facts. You've done this before. You've enjoyed it. You get into a good routine, blah, blah, blah. And I've realised that, you know, when I get to 47, I'll probably be still having these types of conversations. That it might have shifted a bit in terms of how I manage it and, you know, how I embrace it all. But it's always going to be a part of my life, those thoughts, those feelings.
Yeah. And I think they're really common. I think a lot of people have them as well. But I think the important thing, as you say, is to vocalise it and tell someone about it, someone you trust. And then... It's so true about saying about the facts as well. I think once you do sort of... Because it's emotion versus facts, really, isn't it? But if you can sort of then focus on the facts, you will realise you are, you know, more than competent of doing all these things. But I don't think those... Yeah, I don't think those feelings really ever do necessarily completely go away. It's more sort of a management of them. But as you get older, you know yourself and you know maybe how you can manage those situations a bit better. But it's all a sort of learning process.
It's a learning process, and you know, I always find when I've had those moments, even like yesterday, going to meetings, which is something that I do all the time, but for some reason yesterday I was finding it very difficult. When I got back home at the end of the day, I said to myself, I'm bloody proud of you, Michelle. You know, well done, you did it. And I felt good. And the old me, the younger me, probably would have given myself a hard time in that respect. Well, that's something that you should be able to do. That's something that you do all the time. Why are you getting to the point where you're coming home and patting yourself on the back for something that you should be able to do? Whereas I think, you know, as I'm getting older, that self-care, that acknowledgement that you have found it a bit tough you've got through it and you're recognising that and, you know, that reinforcement of yourself and reassurance, just being kinder to yourself in general, which, you know, Giles, I know you talk about a lot, is so, so important. And sometimes it's easier to do for others than it is to, you know, to do consistently for yourself.
Absolutely. I totally agree. And, it's interesting. I was thinking, like, actually, these anxieties and stuff, they, like Jim was saying, they do continue. And I think, obviously, we gain experience. Yeah. But then at the same time, those anxieties are kind of going to be present because of what, it's at stake, maybe, because as we get older, you know, it might be that, you know, we're desperate for money or you know, to, you know, earn a living, or, you know, you see other people doing well and there's all those things as well. So that those things do get exacerbated by the environments that we're in and the world we live in.
Is it also because you care about what you're doing? So my anxieties come from I want to be good at the things I do because I care about the things I do. So I then put pressure on myself to do well in those things, even though I know I can do well in those things. But it's because I care about it. I'm not sort of laissez-faire. I want to do well.
Yeah, it's so true. And I sometimes find, you know, in those moments where almost I don't feel that anxious and I wake up and I'm like, I'm feeling pretty good today. There's another part of me that's like, Michelle, but why aren't you anxious? You know, because I realise that I'm able to deliver and perform well with those elements of anxiety. Yeah. So when they're not there as much, I'm like, oh, well, maybe you're very good because you know, you have those elements of anxiety and it's keeping you on your toes. And, you know, like you say, you want to do well. So it's always there in some respect. And I also feel there's a level of kind of empathy attached. You know, now that we all start talking more about how we feel and you realise that other people are going through it, it's that connection and that wanting to make sure somebody else is okay because you understand that kind of process, which is a part of it that's actually, you know, really special. You can reach out and share your experiences with other people and help them.
And you know they will understand as well. I think that stops a lot of people reaching out. Or maybe in the past, they thought people might think, oh, what are you talking about? But people do, you're right. The conversation has got obviously sort of bigger, which is great. I will say, when I was working at an old job with meetings, so I used to work at two old jobs. One was at a local newspaper, which we've discussed many times on this podcast. But I got to the point where I didn't want to... If someone rang my phone at my desk... I would screen the call because it might be someone that I didn't want to talk to or like something boring. So I'd be like, yeah, hi.
Someone boring.
I mean, you get, when you're a local reporter, you get a lot of, you get a lot of boring council stuff. Like, hello, Seven Oaks Chronicle. Is Jim Daly there? I'll just check for you right now. Hang on. Oh, no, hang on. Who's calling? Someone boring. Okay. I'm so sorry he's away from his desk right now. Can I take a message? Someone interesting. Hello, this is Jim. Nice to, how are you? That worked amazingly. And then also...
It's amazing how your PA sounds exactly like you.
I was just going to say, did you not put a different voice on or something?
I should have put a different voice on. Yeah, I should have put a different voice on. In hindsight, that would have probably worked better.
Yeah.
But also, I did another job a few years later, actually, where we had a lot of meetings. It was it was a gambling company. I was doing marketing stuff, and it was a horrible job. I hated it. But we used to have meetings, pre-meetings, for meetings. So like meetings where we think, oh, how are we going to... And I just stopped, I just stopped going. I just refused to go to the meetings in the end.
I don't blame you, to be honest.
It was... I hated them.
What would you discuss at the pre-meeting meeting then?
Because it would be a meeting about like... it'd be some sort of marketing meeting or something. So the pre-meeting would be our little team. Maybe the next meeting would be with a bigger team. How are we going to get involved in this meeting? And what are we going to say? How are we going to show that we're good at what we do? Oh, it's such bullshit. I hated it so much.
So you stopped going to the meetings and you just stopped answering phone calls. Did you get sacked? Or
I did leave both jobs.
You're just like, nah, I'm not. Although I'm working, I left, but not. Nah.
It doesn't sound like you're feeling everything.
So I did leave both on my own terms, but I think possibly like a manager under pressure left before I was pushed, jumped before I was pushed, maybe.
It's very liberating, though, to just be, you know, I need to do more of that, really, Jim. Don't I just, you know, nah, I'm not feeling boring. You know, there needs to be a but boring.
Screen your calls. Maybe do a different voice tone.
Maybe take it to the next level and do that in the meeting.
That's it, you know,
boring. Right, I'm talking to you, not you.
It's very Alan Partridge. I love it.
But I was going to say, there was a serious point at the end of this. I was going to say that I then did another, I was going to another job at a football website called goal.com. And I was a site manager for a bit. So we were the people that when there was breaking news and stuff, we'd have to like make sure the site had the right stories, right headlines and stuff. It was all about speed, as sort of online news is, all about getting there first and making it short. And I had an appraisal once with my bosses, and they were like, where do you think you need to do better? So firstly, everywhere, but specifically, I find I'm not quick enough. I feel like when something happens, I write a headline, I think about it, I think some more, I double check, and then I think, okay, maybe that's right, and I'm about 30 seconds behind. And they said, and the guy's called Steven, I'll never forget this, Steve, he said, that's not a bad thing, Jim, that's a good thing, because you're second-guessing yourself is not a bad thing. It means that you really care and you want to get this thing right. Mm. And actually, that extra few seconds can actually make the difference between a good and a bad headline. And that's always stuck with me. And I think I sort of use that in other areas of my life as well, where I sort of second-guess what I'm doing. It actually just means that I'm just taking a little second to think about whether I'm doing it right or not. And that's stuck with me a long time.
I like that, Jim. That's very good advice. Very good advice indeed.
Good old Steve.
Yeah, thanks, Steve.
Steve Saunders, that was his last name, Steve Saunders.
You're not boring, nice Steve. We'll keep you. Thank you.
We'll keep you. I was going to say, when you were doing psychology, did any of this stuff come up? Like, it feels like when we do psychology, I did psychology, I think it was GCSE, so it's like very basic. But we didn't talk really about like things like self-esteem and anxiety and stuff. It was more like Freud.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what I wasn't prepared for in psychology was all the statistics, because I am terrible at maths, and that came as a real shock to me. I think going into it, I thought it might be more about, you know, the areas that we're talking about, but it was more kind of heavy science and maths and, you know, Freud and Miller and those kind of things, Jung. But yeah, it kind of gave me the interest in it, but there was a lot of things that kind of didn't relate as much. Do you know what I mean? Mm. I think things have probably evolved since then, because studies are always going on and things are changing. There's never a final answer in psychology, is there? There's always, well, it could be this, but there again, it could be this, or it could be this.
How to have a job for life? Pick psychology where nothing ever ends.
That's it.
Then, yeah. And you're just sorted.
So many variables, you just keep on going.
So you got that, you got a placement at the BBC.
I did.
And then, that leads to sort of like an apprenticeship or something like that, was it? Yeah.
So I remember applying online, because I just started looking, oh, you know, what's TV like? I went on the BBC website and applied for a work experience placement. So at the time it was, you could apply for a 4-week free work experience placement, as in they don't pay you. Mm-hmm. And it said like, oh, you know, it'll take about 3 months or so to get back to us, for them to get back to me. So I kind of timed it in my head. I thought, well, I'm in my third year of university at the minute. I'm doing my dissertation. Maybe if they got back in, like, if I was successful for an interview in 4 months, that would tie in with leaving uni. So I applied, and then they actually got back relatively quickly. They might not have had many applications that month, I don't know. And so I went for this interview for the 4-week experience placement, got the job, And then I ended up basically doing my degree whilst doing work experience at the BBC. It just so happened, thankfully, that my psychology department was just a bit further along the road on Oxford Road in Manchester. So I'd wake up in the morning, go into the BBC, do my work experience. At lunchtime, I'd run to my lecture hall, print out all my notes, run back, do the rest of the afternoon at the BBC, go home, and then spend God knows how many hours at night, like, writing my dissertations and prepping all my work just to try and pack it all in. But I remember the first day, like, walking through the doors of the Beeb, and I got my little badge and my little, you know, my little pass, and I thought, this Murder, She Wrote was on the big screen in the telly as well. I'm obsessed with murder mysteries, so I was like, this is a good sign. And I just felt that sense of excitement, really. And after the 4 week work experience placement, they asked me to stay on, and then so I was working on this documentary, and then went to work on Mastermind, Question of Sport, Dragon's Den, and I just kept getting extended and extended. So literally from my, you know, university degree to kind of stepping through the doors at the BBC, that's in 2005. That's when it started and continued from there, which is mad, really.
I have no idea if work experience is still a thing, but that was when I was at university and secondary school and stuff. It was very much the done thing, like, you would do work experience. And it is, I got my first break in journalism through doing work experience as well. Like, it is unbelievably beneficial, but I don't know if it's still a thing anymore. I don't know.
I don't know, because people often ask me, you know, for advice in terms of getting into the industry. And for me, I literally went on bbc.co.uk and just looked at the website, looked at jobs, applications, and took it from there. I think the apprenticeship schemes are probably quite different now. But I think you're right. You know, even though you're not getting paid, it's a four-week interview, essentially, isn't it? You know, it's, you're there to kind of get your foot in the door, make as many contacts as you can whilst you're there, and also get a flavour for where you might want to go next. Is entertainment your bag? Is it news? Is it sport? And that's kind of how I saw it, and just thought, right, whilst I've got the opportunity, I'll just kind of milk it for what it's worth and see how long I can stay in the building before they chuck me out.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a two-way thing. Like, you know, it's you seeing whoever you want to do that as well.
That is, I mean,
I remember getting made redundant when 6 weeks after our first child was born, and I thought, I want to go try and do something completely different. And I managed to get a work placement at Pinewood Studios, at a post-production company. I thought about doing, like, film editing or something. And I went, and it was, I stayed about 4 days, and it was just the worst job in the world.
Yeah. Really?
It was, like, really, I mean, no one there had children. They all lived in, a lot of them lived miles away because they, you know, they were desperate to work in the industry, so they all lived really far away to get there. So it was loads of travel. It just looked like really, like, gutty kind of work, and I thought, actually, I don't think I really want to do this. Actually, there's not as exciting as it wasn't as exciting as I kind of imagined. So, but that was great. I really was so pleased that I did it, though, because I had that opportunity to see whether it was for me as well.
It works both ways, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? To see, is this the right fit for me? Which is really useful. And I definitely felt like that. You know, there are certain things that I remember working on Question of Sport and thinking, yeah, this is definitely not for me. I know nothing about sport. I remember going to film the mystery guest sections, and there was a guy there, and it was David James. And I was like, oh, he's attractive. He looks like a nice guy. Oh, he's got a lovely dog.
He's tall.
He was tall. Yeah. And he had this beautiful dog. I was so interested in his grey dog. And then the producer was saying, we're actually here to film David James, Michelle.
Yeah, the dog isn't the...
I need to do more research.
Did he have any of his paintings out? Did he show any of his paintings?
Show any of his paintings. Oh, just talking about football, I'm like, oh, yeah, goals. Sorry, what team do you play for? So that wasn't for me. I got out quick.
I think it's... Giles, that's a really interesting story. I didn't know you'd done that. I think it's really... it's important sometimes.
Can I just caveat that the main thing that this company did was they did the post production for In the Night Garden.
Did they?
Which I imagine, yeah. So you know, as anyone who's ever watched that show, I mean, the idea of watching that show for 20 hours a day, editing it, that one of the main editors there, honestly, there was a fault with one of the episodes and he had to redo one. And the life just was sucked out of him. I mean, you could see the blood draining from his face. And I'm thinking, this isn't for me.
Yeah, and often there's no windows in edit suites as well, are there?
There isn't, no. You know? No, it was a little box with lots of little studios and it was very dim and dark. And yeah, they were very lovely people. But
I have a lot of questions about In the Night Garden. Because Michelle, I have a daughter who's nearly two, so my life has become In the Night Garden. Were they all on drugs? Because it is the trippiest show on TV.
Look, I mean, I don't know, because it was just they were obviously just editing footage to make it into the show. I mean, the producers were there. They didn't look like they were on drugs.
It's all very surreal. Maybe that was a caveat, like, for, you know, before you actually work on it, that you have to partake in a bit of drug activity to get the juices flowing or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it's the weirdest show.
It's a highly, highly tuned show. So, I'm just going to say that.
Just leave that
be
there.
Horrible about anyone in the night garden. But, yeah. Wow. So, anyway, I just remember thinking it was, that wasn't for me.
I don't know if it's a modern thing or what, but I think like we're all really scared to like get things wrong and make errors, especially like career wise. But I think actually sometimes it's really empowering to say, oh, actually, I tried something. Mm. It wasn't for me, but it was okay to try it. Like, you know what I mean? Like, people are all sort of scared of going down wrong paths and stuff. Actually, going down a wrong path can actually then leave you in a position where you feel more secure about what you do or don't want to do. So I think we need to sort of maybe eradicate this idea of sort of fear of failure, I guess. I don't know, because it's all part of your journey.
I think you're totally right there. And I do think still, you know, there's quite a bit of work to be done within the media industry or my experience within telly, because it does feel like still there's not that room to confidently say, I made a mistake here. Yeah. I got this wrong. I don't feel that confident. I'm not happy. You know, the pressure is on, especially if you're working in live production teams or even pre-recorded. Everyone's there. Everyone's trying to make an impression. Everyone's trying to do the best that they possibly can. It's almost like there's not enough room to jump off the spinning machine, the treadmill, and say, guys, I'm out. And also to have that duty of care or someone recognise that, well, that's okay. Do you know what I mean? It's like grin and bear it, get on with it. You know, we're all in it and you should be lucky. I think there's still that kind of attitude there for sure.
Yeah. I guess that comes... It's high-pressure environments, I get that, and people are working long hours and stuff, but you're absolutely right. And there's duty of care, such a good way of putting it as well. They're really, really, especially to sort of junior people, I think, to make sure that everyone's happy. Because surely if you've got a happy team, you're going to get sort of more productivity and better results than if you've got a team of stressed people or anxious people who don't feel like they're maybe sort of making the right contribution or...
Yeah, and it's such a simple concept, really, isn't it, when you say it? If people are happy, they're more productive. But that does seem to go by the wayside when people feel stressed or they're out of time. Like, we haven't got time to think about ways to make things more comfortable and make things better for people in order to feel happy. It's like, well, we're going to have to put that by the wayside. And it was interesting. I was having a chat the other day. I do think maybe, hopefully, the pandemic has slightly changed things in the sense that we are realizing, it's amazing, isn't it? It takes a big world event to happen, but we are realizing that people can be productive in not necessarily that stereotypical way where everyone has to come to an office, everyone has to sit at a desk, everyone has to do it in the same way. It's like we're all individual creatures who work differently and, you know, work better in so many different environments and can still be productive. And, you know, hopefully that will lead to better levels of happiness when we can have a more realistic work-life balance and still show that we can get the job done.
Yeah, I think there's been quite a few Twitter threads I've seen of people saying, our boss has said, don't bother coming back to the office, we can all work from home. And I feel, I've got kids and I feel so much happier now. I feel valued as a worker and I feel great. And then other people replying saying, my boss is an arsehole. He says we've got to be in 3 days a week regardless. And it's just, it's almost like potluck as to who you work for and who owns the company as to then whether you're going to be happy at your job or not, which seems massively unfair.
It's mad, isn't it? Down to one person. It depends how nice and empathetic and happy probably they are as a person as to whether it filters down.
Yeah, it seems very unfair. To be honest, one of the reasons I choose to work freelance. I don't know if you're the same, Giles, but I like the idea of being in control of sort of. I mean, it comes with its own anxieties of earning money and stuff like that. But at least I haven't got a boss who is an arsehole. Well, I sort of do, but I'm the boss.
You,
but
yeah, and you can walk away. Exactly. I'm out. This is not Jim, even though it sounds exactly like Jim. I am not Jim today.
Wow,
thank
I
you.
Can't control Jim. He's the worst employee ever. He's unmanageable.
But I think it's proved, well, not just with the pandemic, but I think there's been studies showing that people can work just as, you know, if not more efficiently remotely in some respects. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, I've got to see it's different for everybody. Some people do like that work environment and going in. But I think for a lot of people, it's going to be, they're going to need that, I think, going forward to be able to do that.
I found as well at the start of the pandemic, so March 2020, I ended up doing a live morning show every day, which was basically about what was going on. And, you know, obviously at that time we were all finding out together day by day what we should be doing next. And because of the rules and the restrictions, we couldn't have people in the studio to interview, or if we could, it was extremely limited and various, you know, rules in place. So I remember, you know, initially as a presenter thinking, gosh, this is going to be very different interviewing everybody on a live show over Zoom. You know, how are people going to be? You're still going to be able to get that kind of that contact, and it's that frisson, something that you can't really explain when you're in close proximity with somebody. But interestingly, I found with certain people that I was interviewing, you actually got a better conversation out of them from a distance because they were in their natural environment, and you could have a bit of a laugh with them. You know, I remember speaking to Gabby Roslin, she was in the middle of a garden. I was like, oh, just turn the camera around. And she was in her element. She was showing me all the flowers and, you know, she was skipping around in her bare feet. And it was brilliant because actually you're taking away from that sterile studio environment, putting them in their home environment. Next minute, a dog's running through the screen, or, you know, you get to chat to the husband and the wife as well. It adds a completely different element, which I hadn't realised beforehand, you know, as a presenter thinking, wow, there's something else here that we've touched on and a way to connect, even though we're so physically separate.
Yeah, I think...
Yeah, I mean, we found that with the podcast, haven't we, Jim? I think, because we've obviously switched to doing it like this. We used to go up to London and we would meet in the studio. But I think... And it is nice having that physical contact with people. But at the same time, like you say, because people are in their own environments, they're able to do it at their times as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've been able to do things with people in the US and stuff like that as well. It's made it that easier. I think we have had very candid conversations, and I think that was something we worried about to start with, but it hasn't really changed how we do things in regards to like how the conversations go.
Yeah. And I'm really liking the picture in the back of your shop there, Giles. Like, is that you and your wife? Or?
Yeah, that's on our wedding
day. It's lovely that. Yeah.
So we got it polarised, and then... I think she painted that one. I've done one as well, but yeah, she painted that one.
See, that's lovely. Just, yeah. See, you know, if we were to meet face to face, you wouldn't be bringing that with you, for example. Yeah. So I would never get to see it because you carry it around wherever you go, of course.
Yeah. And I would bring 40 football shirts with me on the rail as well.
That's it. I wish you did Jim.
But you do. You get a little bit of an inkling into people's lives to a certain extent. You can sort of see, they got that on there. Yeah. Okay. Nice wallpaper. That's nice. I think
audiences like that as well. Like, for me, I think this was during the pandemic, but the best thing that happened was that little girl bursting in when her dad was on BBC News. You know, the little girl doing that.
And I think was that the start of
the pandemic? I can't remember. I think it was, but...
That was pre-pandemic, wasn't it? When the mum yanked her out. Yeah, I think that was pre-pandemic.
But there was quite a few...
That was pioneering.
It was.
Little did they know.
It was.
But there was quite a few examples, wasn't there, of people doing stuff from home and then kids coming in and stuff. And it's just, I think audiences really like that. You get to see a real slice of that actual person. And also, audiences like it when stuff goes slightly wrong as well. Like, it's just...
It's like just real, isn't it? Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It's real. I remember watching Graham Norton during the pandemic, and they had an interview with Samuel L. Jackson, who I absolutely love, and I got to interview him on The One Show a few years ago. But the interesting thing was, Graham interviewed him from his home in America, and I saw a completely different side to him, and that was because his wife came in on the interview, who I've never seen before. Yeah. Mm. And basically, Samuel just did not get a word in because she just ruled the roost. She just looked at him and was like, you know, what are you talking about? It was such a brilliant dynamic. And I was like, oh, my God, I've never seen this side. Yeah. You know, it was so refreshing. And she was just such a character that is normally obviously behind the scenes because he's the Hollywood A-list star. But the dynamic and the relationship between them just sat there in the home environment having a laugh is just like, this is awesome. And something that you'd never normally get to see.
No, you wouldn't. That's fascinating.
It's really good.
How do you find doing those interviews with big like A-listers and stuff? Are you okay because you're in the zone of doing work, or do you get a bit starstruck?
I think with Samuel L. Jackson I was, because I've watched all his movies and he walked in and he just had this amazing, like, massive coat on. He was just so cool and chilled. I was like, oh, my God. But normally in those environments, I do try and keep myself in a certain zone. Do you know what I mean? You're kind of in professional mode and you've done all your prep. And also, what, you know, from people that I've interviewed, a lot of the time, they're actually so normal. Mm. I remember interviewing Danny Boyle. He came on The One Show to talk about Trainspotting 2, and he was the loveliest guy ever. We had, like, different VTs in the show, and there was one that one of the producers had done, which was celebrating, like, the anniversary of Desert Island Discs. So they just went into the street and interviewed loads of different people and asked them about their favourite music and what memories it evoked. And normally when you've got people on the sofa there, especially kind of your big directors or actors, they're not necessarily watching the other elements of the show. They've got the people or their agents or, you know, the makeup that are coming in and kind of fluffing them ready for the next bit. But Danny was so engrossed in all the workings of what was going on with the TV. And he got quite tearful watching this 3-minute VT that was made from one of the producers. And he actually said at the end of it, can you get the name of who did that? Because I just want to say I thought that was beautifully done. Oh, wow. And at the end of it, he spent another 40 minutes chatting to all these film students that came into the audience to watch, which again, normally people would, you know, potentially just go and on to their next interview. So things like that, it gives you a different perspective on people, doesn't it? You know, they're there because they're doing their job, they're there to promote it and have a chat, and it's lovely when you've got a certain kind of image of how a person might be and that's completely broken down and you just see them as a nice lad, or do you know what I mean? It's that, those are the moments where you think, wow, probably upon reflection, like, whoa, did that just happen? That was amazing.
Yeah. I love that so much. I'm obsessed with finding out if celebrities are nice, and I don't know why, but I just love finding stories like that they are. I think it's, and I think as well, like, it's not like, obviously other celebs might have other things going on in their day, other things happening behind the scenes, they got to get off or whatever, but so it's not like, you know, he's nice, he's not, but it's just when you find out, I love Danny Boyle as well. That's really made my day, actually.
Yeah, honestly, it's so great. And I do think it's interesting because we do have this kind of perception of, you know, big stars, that if they are essentially normal and say, oh, hello, nice to meet you. My God, they're so nice. Yeah. Like, we're just expecting them all to be dicks. But do you know what I mean? Yeah. But I also think that productions do have a part to play in that, because I even remember, you know, when I first started in work experience, there's a certain behaviour for certain celebrities within a room changes when that person comes in. Everybody's on high alert and not acting normal. So for people coming into the industry that suddenly kind of rise to fame, they get used to people talking to them in a certain way, behaving in a certain way around them. So then they think, well, this is, maybe I need to behave in a certain way. This is what I should expect. And I think sometimes that does breed that rudeness or that standoffishness or, you know, us and them, that separation between the two.
I think that happens in sport as well, because I'm also obsessed with finding out if footballers are nice or not. And I think it's the same thing. You expect them to be dicks. But if they've grown up from the age of 15 and everyone's saying, you're amazing, you're so good, then by the time you get to 25, you're going to have that kind of weird energy and aura about you. So you definitely think celebrity sort of products of their environment a lot of the time. But yeah, when you find out someone's nice, oh God, it's just... It's delicious. Oh, I love it.
It's heartwarming, isn't it? And then also it doesn't ruin it when you see them on TV after you've met them, because you can carry on watching their things and have a nice smile on your face rather than watch it and be like, you idiot. Oh, I'm never watching you ever again. You've ruined my life.
That's so true, yeah.
That's horrible.
You're like very disappointing. You're holding a grudge against this celebrity.
That's it. Secretly, just a massive frown on your face, watching their film with a massive bag of popcorn. Just
I'm gonna
like,
watch it. Really, but I'm not gonna enjoy it. Okay,
exactly. That's it.
So, I mean, obviously, those shows were live. So, and obviously, you did quite a lot of live, broadcasting.
Yeah,
is that must be quite intense.
It is, but it's interesting for me because, you know, like I touched on before, I'm the type of person that I give myself a very hard time. I overthink a lot of things, you know, and for me, live television is probably when I'm the most present, as in I'm not thinking of a million different things at once because I can't, I physically can't. I've got to be so focused on listening to what that person is telling me in order for me to have an appropriate response and be engaged and hear them, that in a weird way, once you're in it, it takes that level of anxiety away from me because my mind can't be going hell for leather on so many different things. It's just got to be focused on the task in hand. So when I come away from doing live shows, I feel a sense of calm. You know, up until it, like all up, you know, there's the adrenaline beforehand and getting, making sure that you're prepped and ready to go. But when I'm actually doing it, that is, I almost feel like I'm on a calm water and just, I really enjoy that process. It feels actually weirdly good for my mental health in some ways. That's, you know, what I've realised about myself, that it works.
That's amazing. I think presenting live TV is one of the hardest skills anyone can have. And I think I've got so much respect for people that do it. You're spinning so many plates. You've got to listen to the interviewer. You've got someone in your ear on talkback. You've got your notes. You have to concentrate on so many things. And I think anyone that can do it well, like yourself, I think really,
I enjoy voices in my ear, really. You know, I enjoy people just talking to me. I remember one director on a show that I was working on, and he just used to like playing tricks on you. So it's actually quite similar to you, Jim, because you'd be having a conversation and then the director would just shout, boring, or he'd be like, oh my God, I don't like her dress. Oh, God. And you'd just be having a separate conversation in your ear. You're like, oh my, right, you got 10 seconds left, but just, you know, just finish it now. I've had enough of this. Like, oh no, this is, but I tell you what, it was a good experience at the start because you do get certain personalities in your ear that, you know, like to talk more than others. So yeah, it is kind of like patting your head and rubbing your stomach or whatever.
That producer wanted to be in front of camera, didn't he?
Really?
Do you reckon? Oh, it sounds like he wanted to be in front of camera.
Oh yeah, that director. Yeah, yeah, probably. I can imagine that actually for sure.
have you had? I mean, I guess obviously sort of doing live stuff brings pitfalls and stuff. Have you had any moments where, to bring it on brand for the podcast, you have gone blank or someone else has gone blank and you've had that sort of that frozen moment or anything like that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I remember, so it was 3 years ago now, my dad passed away from cancer, which was all quite quick. We'd been on holiday and then got back and he was feeling pretty ill. He got admitted to hospital for 2 weeks, and within that time frame we got told that he had stage 4 advanced cancer and had 6 months to live. So it was kind of obviously an incredibly traumatic time for all of us. And you know, at that time I was working hell for leather, and my dad was always like the person that I'd go to chat about any kind of career worries. He was always like my biggest support and my biggest advocate. And at those times where I was like, I just can't do this anymore, he was like, you know, you can, and would always be quite pragmatic and make me think in a different way.
Yeah.
So when he passed away, I kind of just went straight back to work. I think I had a couple of days off and then literally was, you know, straight into it. And I remember doing a live show. I think it was the one show, and we had two chaps on that were promoting a program called Fixing Dad, and it was about their father who'd had health problems, and you know what they were doing to kind of make him healthier, and how important their family was. And I remember sitting there and just feeling so overcome with emotion, but also not feeling confident enough in myself to vocalize what was going through my head, because actually it's only on reflection that I can really realize what it was. I think I was still in a state of shock from what had happened.
Yeah.
I remember just kind of having this out of body experience, thinking, where the hell am I? Oh shit, I'm on live TV. I'm having a conversation with somebody, and I don't feel like I've got the capacity to listen to this, to react to this without kind of breaking down. And, you know, within live TV, pausing for a second sometimes, or 2 seconds, can feel like an age.
Yeah.
And I remember doing that and just thinking, I don't think I can't say anything here. Thankfully, my co-presenter, Matt, he was kind of aware of the situation and kind of, you know, stepped in and carried it on. But I went blank. I just froze and was just thinking, I shouldn't be here. I need to take some time off. I need to take some time away. And then had to get myself back in the game. But it's a scary process when you go through it as well. Because yeah. At that moment, I was thinking, I don't know how to get out of it. I've got into this feeling and it happened so quickly. Mm. How the hell am I going to get out of it with everybody bloody watching at the same time? You know, it was, quite a frightening moment, really.
It's like sort of fight or flight, that moment where you're suddenly, you want to just go, you want to get out, yeah. But obviously you can't because you're there on live TV, but your body is telling you everything else to just run.
Exactly.
I guess.
It was, and it was that very kind of physical reaction, which is almost, well, it's overwhelming and it's something you can't control. And it is amazing how your body, your mind can tell you one thing, or you can just keep going with your mind, or you can tell your mind one thing, but your body at some point, you know, catches up with you, and then something will happen beyond your conscious control. And you think, something's going on here. I need to take some time out. I need to address it, or, you know, I need to talk to someone.
Yeah, well, I'm so sorry about your dad, and I hope you were able to take some time and give yourself some space to recover.
Yeah,
because it is, you know, obviously that's a, you know, a horrible thing to go through.
Yeah, I was, for me that was really kind of a wake up call, and like I said, you know, just having the confidence to say, you know, we touched on it before. I don't feel that great. You know, maybe I've made a mistake here doing this, or you know. I don't think I'm going to give you the best performance at the minute, and being confident enough to jump off that treadmill and, you know, jump back on it again when you feel the time's right.
Yeah, and sometimes when we're in having traumatic moments, when we're going through trauma, we do try and avoid it. So we dive into what we're used to because we feel like it's, you know, that will cover up everything that I've got going on, you know.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, it's easy to do. And I think we, you know, we probably all do it at some point in our lives. I understand that,
yeah.
and do empathise with it.
Yeah, sometimes it's easy just to kind of, like you say, jump into what feels like a comfortable space at the time. Mm. And I've done that as well, you know, especially after my dad passed away. It was a real time of trying to figure out what actually was making me feel comfortable, what was making me feel overly comfortable, and actually in the long run wasn't helping me.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so there was taking time out, but then I went through a period of like literally not leaving the house, you know, because I thought, well, this is a comfortable space and I need time off, and So I just I think I was watching Game of Thrones on, you know, back to back on, which is a bit of a traumatic thing to watch when you're grieving anyway. Do you know what I mean? Just people like Gilly. I was like, what am I doing? But then it got to the point where I was like, I don't think this is actually helping. Maybe I need a sense of routine and to push myself out of this, because I could easily stay in here for the next 3 months and not go out again. You know, so it's taking that time to work out what does make you feel comfortable, but almost not too comfortable that you get stuck in a cycle that's unhealthy for you that you can't get out of. And that's where it helps again to talk to other people and get perspective, and someone else see something a bit more objectively and think, okay, well, maybe you need to do this, or let's go for a walk here, or maybe you could do a bit of work here, you know?
Yeah, and it gets said a lot, doesn't it, these days, quite rightly, that talking to people helps. But it's a cliche because it's true. Like, it's so true. Yeah. And whether that is someone in a professional capacity or a best friend or someone who knows you, I've found anyway, certainly, and I obviously can't speak for everyone, it's never a bad thing to do. It always feels like there's a weight comes off, or as you say, you see a different perspective. Even if it's a really quick WhatsApp or a quick message, I found it's always been really helpful.
Yeah, I was definitely, you know, when I was younger, the type of person that wouldn't really speak that much about how I was feeling, just that classic, oh yeah, I'm fine. Mm. I'd always be the one that would listen, but I would never kind of contribute how I was feeling, which really is kind of unfair, to that other person as well, because it needs to be, you know, a mutual exchange. I think that's what helps us all when we feel like we can relate. But even, you know, since the pandemic, it's interesting how, you know, myself and my friends, we've all reached out to people in different ways. Like even this morning, I don't know about you guys, but I've got so used to using WhatsApp voice notes on my phone. Because
I can't even be bothered to type them.
This is it. But it's actually really lovely because, you know, I've still not seen some of my friends, you know, since pre-pandemic. And just to hear their voice on the other end of the phone and then, you know, drop them one back, it's really nice. And it is that kind of... You can tell sometimes in somebody's voice when they say, oh, yeah, I'm fine. It's different to a message or an email. Yeah. And then you can react and respond and say, right, OK, what's going on? Let's book in to have a proper chat or a Zoom or whatever.
Yeah.
So it is kind of just keeping that connection going. And even a small I'm fine can tell you how someone's really feeling, you know, in the sound of their voice.
Absolutely. Do you guys think, weirdly, sort of the pandemic and the lockdown and being away from each other has, in a way, brought us closer to people?
Yeah, I definitely do. I think it's made us probably more selective as well. You know, you've heard this. Some people blame the pandemic. Oh, can't meet because of the pandemic.
So true.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's always good to have a bit of a cleanse and a refresh sometimes, isn't it? When you realise actually those friends aren't really friends. You can't actually be arsed meeting them. It's like pandemic. Pandemic.
Yeah. Oh, I've been pinged. Sorry, I've been pinged. Yeah. So I can't.
Exactly. Yeah. But then for those people that you really want to connect with, you do. I think, well, it's certainly made me realise, you know, those friendships that mean the most to me, I've really made an effort to continue. And even though we've not seen each other face to face for a while, I feel like we have grown closer because we're speaking nearly every other day, you know, which is because we both want to maintain it. There's that fear of kind of we've all kind of, you know, lost in different ways because of the pandemic, and you don't want to lose those things that mean so much to you. So you're trying to make more of an effort to keep them alive.
Oh, I wholeheartedly agree. Yeah, I did a lot of that, just sending messages out during the pandemic just to people, just to keep that connection going. And it was lovely. It's lovely hearing back from people. And then, like you say, you can whittle out the ones that don't answer.
Charles is very good. Oh, sorry, Charles is very, very good at that. He was sending out care packages to friends over WhatsApp.
Charles is
very, very, very good at that. Yeah.
So what's included in a care package?
Oh, I'll send you it. It's a digital care package. It's got all sorts in it.
That's amazing, that.
It's got little games. It's got adult colouring in. There's an episode of the best of blank volume one.
What else what is in there?
I'm trying to remember that. Wicked.
Yeah.
That is wicked.
Dingbats. There's all sorts of stuff in it.
Oh, I love
how
that.
How to play Shithead. Do you remember Shithead?
Is that the one they put the forehead on you?
No, it's a card game.
Don't remember that one.
So, yeah.
I'll have to look that up.
Well, no, well, you don't need to. I'm going to send you the instructions in the digital
care package.
Now
I've got the care package. It's great. Thank you. I look forward to that.
You're very welcome. I'll send it over.
Did you find when you came out of the pandemic, though, that actually when you were meeting people face-to-face, you forgot how to, like, normally socialise? Forgot how to behave and, I don't know. I'm still coming to terms with that sometimes with people that I've not met for a while, like, oh, who speaks now? And how do I sit and just...
The post-match analysis went like doubled up, like, you know, afterwards thinking, oh no, I was terrible in that conversation.
Yeah, but the other person would be thinking the exact same thing.
Yeah, probably. Yeah,
that's it.
Yeah, it has been a bit weird, but I think we're all probably thinking the same things, all doing the same analysis, all probably having the same slight anxieties about it. And we'll get there. It's going to be a slow process because we're sort of out of it, but sort of dealing with the tail end of it, I guess, in a way, aren't we? So it's going to be.
I tell you what, weird. I miss from it though. Days on end doing puzzles. I think I must have done about 20 odd puzzles. I became so good at them because I had a really strong method. You always start with the corners. You've got to do your organisation at the very, very start. All the pieces need turning over. You need to get your corners in place and then colour code it a bit, you know, according to the picture. Yeah.
How big? Like, we talking 500?
Oh, no. 1,000? 1,000 to 2,000.
Come on, Charles. 2,000. Come on, this is Premier League level puzzle doing.
Sorry. Have you got one of those mats?
I haven't got a mat, but I did change the room, so making sure that the table was actually directly above the main light so I could really see. Because I was going into the night, like 1 a.m, I'd still be doing the puzzle. And then I got my friend into it over voice note, and she introduced me to the ultimate puzzle, which was an all-white puzzle. So just...
That sounds...
It blows your mind.
That is hardcore.
It was so hard. There were a few tears and some real frustration, but I got... I must have a picture somewhere. I'll exchange you the picture for the care package. But that was a real highlight for me during the pandemic, yeah.
Do you know what I'm hearing, Michelle, as you're saying that? I'm hearing either new YouTube channel, which will definitely take off, or TV pitch. That's a TV pitch, because I think that'd be quite a calming...
What, like Joy of Painting? Yeah. The Joy of Puzzles?
I think people would watch that.
The new Bob Harris.
And what would it be? Just like me on a time lapse, just doing a white puzzle.
Doing a white puzzle, talking through it, maybe, talking through how you're feeling.
I think, Techniques
at the start. Techniques at the start.
Always do the corners
first.
What you
need is, you know, on Drag Race, they have the confessionals or like a post-match interview. It's then cutting to you going, well, I really struggled with the first corner, but it was the moment when I found the extra little piece that I realised. And then you cut back and you show the action, maybe slow motion replay.
I really like that. And it's the element of jeopardy as well. And you've just got to have that realness of it.
The drama.
When I'm getting frustrated and I'm crying, you've got to show that.
Exactly.
Because this is all a part of...
Exactly.
No one understands, you know, the plight of a puzzle doer. I think...
What are you, a puzzler? What's the...
Oh, yeah.
Is it a puzzle goer? Well, I am a puzzler because I do arrow words as well. I'm obsessed with arrow words. But that's a whole different story. Maybe for
there's
another time.
There'd be some conventions that you can visit and stuff, I should imagine.
Perhaps. I mean, when I get into kind of puzzling, and I'm learning French at the minute, so there's an app that I go on that kind of gives you all these quizzes and puzzles that you do, and I'm at the top of the league on that. I've got 2,000 odd points. The person in second's only got 400.
So, are you good at languages, at picking up languages? I'm terrible.
I enjoy languages. I did French and German at school. I got an A star in German GCSE, and I don't remember any of it because I didn't enjoy it. Yeah. And I remember my German teacher was very annoyed with me because I didn't continue it to A level. But it was like rote learning, you know, like memorise a passage and then just regurgitate it on paper and then I'll get the grade. But for me, I really enjoy French. I wasn't as good at it in school, but I have French lessons every Sunday morning with a tutor on Zoom and do all my homework. I'm really getting into it, and hopefully when we can travel again, I'll have the confidence to, you know, speak it a bit more. Because when you go to France, you know, I've tried before, and if you're not, you know, getting with it, then people will reply back to you in English. So I want to get to the point where I actually sound French.
Yeah.
You know, it's making a bit more sense.
Yeah, but the only way to do that is to go to the country, any language. You've got to go there and just immerse yourself, really. And,
exactly.
And there's no substitute for doing that. Michelle, I've just realised you've got to go in a bit, haven't you? I think you want to...
I have. Time. I've got voiceover for a new series that I'm doing with my mum, so...
Oh, fantastic.
Heading over to London.
And then you've got to pitch the puzzling series as well, so obviously you need then, to work
well, I really need to factor that in. I'll do a bit of self-talk in the mirror beforehand as well. You can do this. Stop feeling anxious. You're a puzzler.
You're a puzzler at heart.
Maybe I'll say it in French. Just to really get myself going.
Puzzler.
Yeah. That's it.
Yeah.
That's it.
Well, Michelle, thank you so much. It's been such a treat to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming on.
It's been great. It's perked up my Thursday morning. Thank you very much. Good.
Amazing.
Well,
thank you.
Likewise, it's lovely to have a proper conversation with you. So thank you.
Definitely. Cheers, guys.
Go Michelle Ackley on the Blank Podcast. What a fantastic guest. Lovely conversation, really easy, flowed along really quickly. Before I knew it, we're an hour in. I was like, I saw the time, I thought, Michelle's got to go by 11. Oh, we better wrap this up. what a fantastic guest, and just a very, you can tell, a very kind and thoughtful person that really sort of came across even on Zoom. And some fantastic advice, some lovely insight, and you know, she shared a few sort of painful moments with us as well, and we do appreciate when our guests do that. We hope it means they're feeling sort of comfortable and in a place to be able to do that. So yeah, Michelle, thank you so much. I really appreciate you coming on, and it was just a joy talking to you.
Yeah, thank you, Michelle. It was really, 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 really lovely to talk to you and touch base. And yeah, I've got to know Michelle a bit over on Twitter. And yeah, she's just a really, really lovely person. Such a warm personality, and her energy is so great. So yeah, it was lovely to have her on the podcast. So thank you very much for coming on. And thanks for listening, everybody.
Indeed. And you can tell, I think that's, you can tell us why she's been so successful in her career. Because to do what she does, you have to be warm and engaging and be able to connect to people really quickly, I think, especially if you're doing sort of live TV. And you can tell that she's really good at that. So, and as I said on the pod, it's a hard skill. I've done a little bit of presenting live TV. It's unbelievably difficult. And I think people that make it look easy, like she does, I think have got a real skill for that. So, it was lovely talking to her. But that, Giles, brings to the end another episode. I don't know what it is. 133, did you say 130?
No, it's much higher than that.
Oh, my word. I'm actually losing count of... for all our episodes.
We're well on the way to 150.
Let's. We got anything planned for 150? Are we going to do anything special?
Nah. Oh, well, we'll have a great guest on, I'm sure.
We always do.
But there won't be anything extra.
Shall I bring something? Party poppers or something? Or
I'd save that for the episode 200.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. We'll make a cake for 200. If any of our listeners are good at making cakes, in about a year... Oh, yes,
I'm right at making cakes. Yeah, I can make a cake.
So in about a year and a half. Oh, what do I like?
Make a carrot cake. Classic carrot cake, okay. Victoria sponge.
Victoria sponge, can't go wrong.
Coffee and walnut.
Coffee. No, not coffee. Not a coffee fan, really.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I would drink a black coffee once throughout the day, maybe in the morning, but anything with coffee flavour in it, biscuit, anything like biscuit, Quality Street, anything like that, can't abide it.
Interesting.
Yeah, sorry.
Lemon drizzle?
Oh, yes. So I went a bit Churchill dog then, didn't I?
Yeah, you did. Oh, yes.
Lemon drizzle, definitely.
Okay, that's
two reasons that's good. Tastes nice, and it's probably the most fun to say of all the cakes. Lemon drizzle.
Yeah. Drizzle.
Drizzle. Drizzle
is a good word, isn't it?
It's a great word.
Is it onomatopoeic? I suppose it is. Drizzle.
Drizzle. Kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
We are really pushing our luck with this chat. I think we should wrap up and thank our listeners. Thank our patrons as well. Thank you so much for your support.
If you want some extra content, you can. Get it.
Indeed. Patreon.com/blankpodcast. every guest we have. We have extra content just for our patrons. So thank you so much. If you signed up, we love you. And your names are in the show notes as well. So you're part of the pod team. You're part of what makes this pod special. So thank you. And thank you, Giles, for just being you.
And you, Jim.
And that's... this is the bit again, if people listen to it, where you realize that we are not the professional. Michelle was a professional, we are not the professionals. The fact we managed to get through most podcasts without stumbling over our words and moments like that is a miracle, really.
I think I do stumble over my words every podcast. Apologies.
I didn't notice
us
actually.
Not being professional broadcasters.
I don't think you do. I didn't notice that. So
yeah. Just that post-match analysis again, isn't it?
Yeah, well, there you go. Well, I'm off to go and do some post-match analysis now of this. So, I would say with blank, it's the thing I do the least analysis for, actually, because I have such a nice time doing the pod. it's so enjoyable because I do other podcasts and I feel like I analyse them. I hate them. Yeah. The worst. No, I don't know. But the blank is so... enjoyable and I find it very easy. Yeah, sort of have less anxiety attached to it, weirdly.
That's good.
Yeah,
it's a good thing.
Then the guests help when the guests come on and they're just as nice as Michelle was, which basically all our guests are. It just makes, whereas the guests on the other podcasts, oh my god, they are the worst. They're lovely. Stop talking, Jim, and wrap the podcast up. Thank you for listening. Thank you to our patrons. Why am I thanking everyone again? Goodbye.
Fuck off.
This is a Blast Box Media Podcast.